When speaking of prophetic messengers, what does the word integrity mean, as in the phrase, the integrity of the prophetic gift? Welcome to The Good Word. My conversations partners today are Dave Thomas and Zdravko Stefanovic, colleagues from the Walla Walla University School of Theology, and we are, in fact, discussing the question of the integrity of the prophetic gift. Now, that topic, you might say, has been given to us, but I would like to toss out, what does the word integrity suggest? Good, bad, and indifferent. Why would that be a topic for a whole week's discussion about the prophetic gift? What do we mean by integrity?
Well, I would think that the integrity is a way of describing the fact that the messages come down to us untarnished and uncompromised, that it has come preserved in a good, it preserved as it was set down, in other words.
Okay.
I think integrity would also be a way of talking about the connection of the prophet, the authenticity of the prophet's calling from God.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think in common language, integrity, well, at least in the minds of some, it seems to be connected with the idea of originality.
Zdravko?
And I fully agree with that, and I would like to add to that that when we listen to the prophets or we read the prophetic writings, some things that they said were very much against the current and the culture in their time.
The status quo, yeah.
Yes, and on the other hand, they may have taken the approaches that were common in their times, and that sometimes confuses people. Immediately the question comes, where does this come from? There is a similarity. Does it imply borrowing? And so on. So I believe that we should not take a simplistic approach, because a prophet may say something with which people would agree in his time, mm-hmm. and yet there were messages that were very unique.
Mm-hmm. One example that comes to mind from the Bible is the story of Jeremiah 36, when the question of the integrity of the prophetic message came up. Jeremiah was forbidden to go to the temple, and so he dictated a scroll to his secretary, Baruch. And when Baruch went to the temple and read the message, the question was, did you write this yourself, mm-hmm. or did you get it from Jeremiah?
Mm-hmm.
So there was a question here of where did this come from?
Mm-hmm. And he answered by saying Jeremiah dictated that to him.
At the mouth of Jeremiah, you see. Mm-hmm. So it's really intriguing that that question comes up. Now, what I've discovered is that students and even preachers are sometimes shaken when they discover the evidence of editing, for example, even fairly innocent editing. I remember one of my colleagues was doing a workers' meeting a number of years ago, when this question was very much discussed among preachers, and he went to the end of Jeremiah chapter 51 to use as an illustration. Now, the end of Jeremiah, you have a whole section there that is entitled Oracles Against the Nations. In the English Bible, it's about 45 to 51. There are several chapters there. But chapter 51 concludes with this line, thus far are the words of Jeremiah, period. But if you look at your book of Jeremiah, there is another whole chapter that follows, chapter 52. Now, if you look at it carefully, that chapter 52 is simply an echo, an almost verbatim replica of the last chapter of 2 Kings. And what it does is simply say, Jeremiah predicted that Jerusalem would be destroyed. We're going to tuck in here the proof of that. But when my good colleague, Brother John, was presenting this to a bunch of pastors, there were two pastors that were just shaken to the tips of their toes by that line, thus far are the words of Jeremiah, because they saw in their Bibles that there was another chapter mm-hmm. and their first thought was, Jeremiah didn't write that last chapter, therefore it's not inspired. So somehow we have to get across this idea that the Bible writers can get their material from anywhere. Do either of you have examples teaching where you found effective ways of doing that? Because a surprise, a deadly surprise when you're studying the Bible can be so destructive of spiritual life when all of a sudden you discover that it's not what you thought it was supposed to be.
Well, one thing that I've found very helpful is to talk a little bit about the history of the Bible. And actually, the Bible as we know it is not very old when compared to the history of the faith community. And, you know, most people down through the ages have not had a Bible. It's probably true that most Christians today do not have a Bible. Those of us in the Western world have many Bibles, but every time I go into other parts of the world, there are people who, they want Bibles, they don't have Bibles. And so, you know, I find that helpful because it helps people see that the Bible is not the sole criteria by which your Christian experience can be had. That you can become a Christian from hearing, you can, you know, from various experiences. Mm-hmm. Of course, the Bible is invaluable as it's in its testimony, but it's not essential to faith. I think sometimes we are guilty of bibliolatry, the worship of the Bible. Mm-hmm. The Bible is a document that has been put together, made up of writings that were done by human beings, and so it shows evidences of the human side. But the message, of course, is profoundly divine.
Mm-hmm.
There are other examples that can be found in the Bible and regarding the issue that you are raising, like the end of Jeremiah 36, where it says that Jeremiah took another scroll and gave it to his scribe, Baruch. And Baruch wrote at Jeremiah's dictation, and Baruch wrote everything, and the chapter ends with these words, and many similar words were added to them. Mm. Now, I personally feel very privileged to live in this time of world's history, because when I was younger, I believe that there was not so much search for the message of the Bible as it is today. One of the key terms used in biblical hermeneutics today is the term message. And as soon as I mention that means I'm looking at a bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not trying to find a great revelation from the Lord in every comma or making the message of the whole passage dependent on the presence or the absence of the quotation marks and so on. But I look at the bigger picture. What is this all about?
Mm-hmm.
And if we keep that in mind, then I think that we'll not major on minors.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
And therefore, I fully agree with what has been said before, that we are among the rare people who have this luxury of having 66 books of the Bible. In Bible times, people did not. If they could mm-hmm. afford a few verses, copies of a few verses, they were lucky mm-hmm. and specially blessed. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that we need to be so much concerned by those details, because it is the bigger picture, the message of the Bible that matters.
And see, Alden, the minute you start trying to translate the Bible from one language to another, or the minute you try to start preaching it to explain to people the message, it amazes me how clear this thing becomes. That, you know, when you translate from one language to another, you sometimes have to use dynamic equivalents. There are many times when there's not an exact word in another language. So what are you going to do?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you default to what will best convey the message.
Mm-hmm.
The same is true with preaching, is that, you know, you try to mine the text for its essential message, and then there are many ways. You could sing it, you could act it out, you could preach it, you could, that's enough examples, but the message could still be conveyed.
Mm-hmm.
So I like what Strafko said, is that this is a very healthy thing for us to be focusing on the message of the Bible, not mm-hmm. the commas and the mm-hmm. exact words that you might find.
Just briefly, one tiny example, when the prophets were warning people that if they do not repent, God is going to discipline them. One term that they like to use is, God will send to you the cleanness of teeth. That's mm-hmm. the literal meaning, yeah. you know, of the phrase in Hebrew. And it's an idiom which means famine, mm-hmm. the cleanness of teeth.
It's not talking about Colgate.
No.
The cleanness of teeth, that's right. And sometimes it is really tough. The Contemporary English Version, for example, is a good example of where people have said, we want to write the Bible in such a way that people who are not used to biblical languages or, you know, modern translations can get the message. And I love to play with this in my students. I say, take the word ark, A-R-K. Can any of you think of a sentence anywhere at any time in a secular setting where we use that word ark? It's simply not true. But we use it in two different ways in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And I ask my students, what does ark mean then? Mm-hmm. Big boat or big box?
See?
And so the contemporary English version makes that kind of transition and uses that. The problem with that then is if people get used to all that non-church language, when they come into the church and hear people talking about the Ark of the Covenant, they'll say, what is that?
But see, that there I think you touch on a thing, on a major point, is that once you become familiar with a certain flow of language or a certain description of something, it sounds almost unholy for somebody to describe it in a different way, even though the essence, it remains there.
That's right. One a good example in my thinking, my favorite New Testament prayer, one of my favorite New Testament prayers is, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief.
Mm-hmm.
But modern translations, virtually without exception, drop out the Lord. Mm-hmm. Now, it doesn't change the substance of the prayer at all to simply say, I believe, help my unbelief, but it doesn't feel right.
Yeah, because we get attached to particular translations.
Right, that's right.
Yeah.
Now, there's one other story that I'd like for us to make a quick reference to. The story of Micaiah and Ahab, because it does have to do with the integrity of the prophetic gift in quite a different way. Jehoshaphat and Ahab were coming together. Jehoshaphat should not have been there, but he was. And he said, you got any prophets to tell us whether we should go out to Ramoth-Gilead? Lots of prophets. 400 came by, and without exception, each one said, go up, and the Lord will give it in the hand of the king. And Jehoshaphat somehow sensed that things were a bit fishy. Do you have anyone else? Well, yes, there's Micaiah, but I hate him because he never speaks any good thing, but only evil. Now, can we depend on that kind of sixth sense of telling whether or not a person is speaking for the Lord? That seems to be the case with Jehoshaphat. He seemed to sense that there was something fishy about these prophets.
Well, see, that's a very difficult thing to quantify, but I think there's some truth to it. There's a certain ring of authenticity that I think is ministered to our understanding by the Holy Spirit that we know when the message came from God.
Mm-hmm.
And the phenomenon prophets for profit is still relevant, I believe, because there are people who can make millions by making predictions, and their books end up in the attic in a year or two after.
Yeah. That's right. So, integrity means a number of things, and it's important for us to accept the decision of the believing community. Jeremiah is a good example. He was forbidden from the temple, but in the end of time, they said he was speaking for God. Well, that's enough for this time. Next week, we're going to talk about the message of the prophets, and Brother Dave and Brother Stravko will be with me again. My thanks to Josiah Hakarat, our program engineer, and to all of you for listening in. For Good Word, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.